All right, well, tonight we're going to be learning about the law. The law, one of those strange parts of Scripture I suspect most of us don't really spend much time reading. We probably just skip over it. Is it still going? Yeah. Sometimes with bad weather it cuts out, so just let me know. We'll try it on Wi-Fi. We'll try it on just my cell signal if it doesn't work on this church's Wi-Fi. All kinds of strange and weird commandments, stuff that doesn't seem to really connect with us. It definitely describes life for people in a very different world than we live in, much more agrarian, much less urbanized, certainly much less mechanized. The penalties strike us as unreasonably harsh in many cases, sometimes fairly arbitrary. And the commands, as I just said before, they seem often irrelevant to us. And so it's not easy for us to quite easily discern what the law has to say for us now. And of course, the big, perhaps, objection from the Christian point of view is, doesn't the New Testament say that we're no longer bound by the law, that we no longer have to follow it? The New Testament does certainly strongly indicate that, not least in our Galatians reading we heard just earlier this evening, that the law had us in bondage. Paul talks about this at length in Romans. We're going to be getting to this in a few weeks in the spring. But the New Testament does also teach, as did the collect that we heard this last Sunday, one of the great Cranmerian collects, original to him in our prayer book tradition, that all of Scripture is inspired by God to edify the saints and to equip them for every good work. And when the New Testament uses this language to describe the law, it's not describing the New Testament. It's describing the Hebrew canon, the Tanakh. The Old Testament, we now know it as. And so, while the New Testament can in some places suggest that the law is no longer binding on the Christian, in other places it talks about how the law, along with every other jot and tittle of the Old Testament, points us to Jesus. And so there is, at least in theory, something that we should be able to still get out of it when we read it. Of course, the early Jews definitely didn't have this conception of the law as burdensome and unbearable. Reflections on the grandeur of the law of God in Psalm 119, the longest single psalm, the longest chapter of the Bible, suggests that this was a source of great meditation and delight for the Jewish faithful. We saw that also in our psalm reading tonight, Psalm 19, and it compares the way this law speaks to the whole person. And illumines the dark corners of our hearts to the way the sun combs over sky, and there's nothing hidden from its burning heat. This is written by people who live in a very arid part of the world next to a desert, so the metaphor of sunlight just piercing everything would have been quite a potent metaphor to describe the way God's law also pierces our souls and reveals to us our hidden faults that we might confess them to God. Several Christians have made attempts in the past to help us navigate the law, help us divide it up in ways that might make it more applicable or understandable to us. And probably the most famous of that is the tripartite division. As far as I know, it was first systematically developed by Thomas Aquinas, but it was picked up by the Protestant reformers as well, especially John Calvin, who also used it to help understand the various types of law. They broke it up into three divisions. The civil law, which describes those aspects of the law regarding the social life of the Israelites, their social responsibilities, and the penal code. So how they were to navigate their common life together, what we might now think of as law today. The next piece of law was called the ceremonial law. And this portion of the law describes laws concerning the tabernacle, priests, sacrifices, and the liturgical year, the sort of great annual festivals of the Israelite nation. And the last bit of the law, the third piece, is called the moral law. Moral law. And that's most especially exemplified by the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments. Which are actually repeated twice. Exodus chapter 20, that's the actual first word of God to the Israelites when they get to Mount Sinai, is the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words. That's what the word Decalogue means, Ten Words. But then it's repeated again in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And there's some variations here and there in terms of the precise wording, but the content's basically identical. And then Deuteronomy equates the Ten Commandments with the tablets that Moses brought down from Sinai. And so that's often why you see the Ten Commandments written on those two tablets and depictions of Moses, because Deuteronomy seems to equate what happened to those tablets, specifically the Ten Commandments. Of these three, only the moral law continues to be binding on Christians because it describes timeless truths, so the theory goes. And so the rest of these things have been abrogated by Christ. They've been fulfilled by him and therefore are no longer applicable to the Christian. Now, within the moral law itself, John Calvin does sometimes extend this to the ceremonial law, there are three uses for the law for modern Christians. One of them is the so-called civil use. And this is for restraining vice. This is for curtailing the effects of human sinfulness, particularly on the body politic. The next use is what's called the pedagogic use. And that actually comes from the word pedagogus in Greek, which was in our Galatians reading tonight, translated by the word guardian. And a pedagogue was somebody that would escort children to school, and so he was responsible for their well-being while they were in transit. Now we tend to associate the term with just teaching in general. Pedagogy is the study of the art of teaching. And the pedagogic use, it comes from Paul's language in Galatians and Romans, is primarily to teach us about ourselves, teach us about our sinfulness, to show us God's standards. And by virtue of doing just that, we are become aware of how we've fallen short of them. And then, of course, it drives us to Jesus. It drives us to have faith in him and to realize that we can't possibly fulfill God's righteous commandments by just mustering up the strength. We have to plead for grace. And so the law teaches us that we need grace in order to be in God's presence. And the last use is sometimes just called the third use of the law, and it's the didactic use. This also means teaching or to speak. And this is to guide the Christian in the formation of their moral life. And so Lutherans also use this same schema. John Calvin first sort of developed this. And the way they sort of summarize it, the civil use is designed to curb, i.e. to curb sin. The pedagogic use is designed to mirror, i.e. to show us our sin, to drive us to need grace, to realize we need grace. And the third use is called to guide. We need to guide the Christian in the way they live their lives ethically. This schema has some utility to it. It's helpful sometimes to help us have some clarity about those parts of the law we can safely set aside as no longer binding on the Christian, like not using two different kinds of threads in clothing or whatever. There's some difficulty to it, though, and that's that the law itself doesn't divide itself this way. And in fact, these three elements are just mixed in together. I mean, you'll have series of texts, and all three of these might show up all mixed together. So they don't occur like, here's the civil portion of the law, now next chapter, moral portion. So it's not always clear which is which, and we got to figure out which is which. And some precepts don't obviously belong in one category or another. And the one that came to my mind was the idea of the Sabbath. Nowadays, we Christians think that we don't observe the Sabbath. Paul seems to suggest as much when he critiques those who insist on Sabbath observance in Galatians. And yet, the Sabbath is part of the Ten Commandments, which is basically universally believed by Christians to be one of the pure summaries of the moral law. It's the only one of the Ten Commandments that's just not obviously eternally relevant, because the rest are about murdering and stealing and giving false witness, and all of a sudden there's Sabbath. And if you see the Ten Commandments as structured in a hierarchy, with the most important commandments at the top, moving our way down, Sabbath is number four. It's towards the top of the list. So the question then becomes, well, are we not following the Sabbath at all? Are we not bound to follow it at all? Or are Christians just following the Sabbath differently now than the Old Testament Jews did? And you can make an argument that they are, that Christians setting aside Sunday as the day of the resurrection, as opposed to Saturday, And not doing work, but praising God on that day is a Christian version of the Sabbath. In fact, the early Christians understood it in that way. And so while the law is about working and how far you could go with carrying something, all that stuff, that's gone away. And that's probably what Paul meant when he talked about getting rid of the Sabbath. Christians do still have the sense that at least one day out of seven ought to be set aside for God's work. In part because God himself roots that commandment in the order of creation and not the fall. So there we have a commandment that doesn't obviously fall into. It could either be moral, or it could be ceremonial, or it could even be civil. I mean, depending on how you look at it. And then, of course, the third problem that I was looking at, that came to me as I was looking at this, is that you might have laws that are clearly, obviously, in one of these two categories, and so therefore aren't binding. But then one of the New Testament writers clearly then makes a moral application from. And the famous example is the passage from Deuteronomy 25:4, when Paul says, "Do not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain." This is obviously about tending to the livestock that we own, and is clearly for people who tend livestock, which is not the urban early Christians. But then Paul goes on to say in 1 Corinthians 9:9 and following, "Is it for oxen that God is concerned?" And he says, "No. Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop." So Paul is distilling from this civil law a principle of binding moral significance that people who invest in the production ought to enjoy it. And in fact, Paul's even more specific than that. He's talking specifically about what in this passage? Anybody remember what he's talking about? It comes up twice in two of his letters.
Missionaries.
Right. Clergy. He's talking about how ministers ought to be paid for their service to the church. And so he's applying this civil law about how we treat our animals to the notion that we ought to pay our clergy. We ought to pay people committed to full-time Christian ministry so they can be free to do that work. And that certainly seems to be a principle of ethics that is, in some sense, eternal. It speaks to something which is always true. of course, even this law itself, Paul, when he applies this law in this way, is actually engaged in a very typical rabbinical practice with the law. It's a principle called from lesser to greater. And the idea that the law often assumes much more than it just is stating on its face. And so what they would say in response to this particular verse, we have rabbis that said this, evidence that they said this at the time of Paul or shortly after, that if God has this kind of concern for animals, and he also cares more for us than he cares for animals, then the same principles also apply to people and not just to animals. So we can deduce from the lesser that the greater is also true in this case. And Paul is engaging in that exercise when he applies this particular passage to the pay of ministers. And so here you have an example of a law that's now being used, you know, one of these two categories that's being applied in this way, and therefore is, according to this schema, binding on all Christians. This way Paul uses this law actually brings us to a pretty important clue about the law's continuing usefulness for us today. And it starts by getting us more into the mindset of the original context in which this law was delivered and the original people to whom it was delivered and the way they tended to think about these things and the way they applied it to their common life. And they had a much more holistic understanding of the law than we tend now to. They saw it as something that speaks to the whole of our lives and not just to our civic responsibilities. And this is actually borne out by the word Torah itself in Hebrew. We tend to think of Torah as law, but Torah is more than just law for the Hebrew. It is instruction. It's guidance. It's teaching for life. It's wisdom. And so when the psalmist meditates on just the grandeur of Torah, which is often translated law by English translators, he's not just talking about positive law that we now think of when we think of law. They're talking about a much more holistic approach to how we live our lives as human beings. And of course, the Torah as a word also applies to the whole first five books of the Bible. That's what that division of the Old Testament canon is called by the Jews. When I used the word Tanakh before, it's actually an abbreviation for the three parts of the Hebrew canon. And the T in Tanakh is Torah, which is the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, all five of the books together. And we know that all five of those books aren't just law. There's stories, and there are principles derived from those stories. Even the law that's presented in there is not quite what we're used to. It's what's called casuistic law as opposed to positive law. A positive law or statutory law is what we now have in the West, and it tends to be very precise. You know, the wording of a law is very tightly written to only be applicable in a particular case. It's why, for example, a man can have his parking ticket overturned in Maine on the basis of the Oxford comma. You know, without the Oxford comma, the law means something slightly different, and the judge actually sided with him, and he got out of his ticket. This was in the news a few years back, right? And the reason why that works is because laws are very narrowly written to apply to very specific circumstances. That's called positive law. And Hebrew law doesn't function that way. It's casuistic, which means it describes cases or circumstances. And the idea was that principles could be derived from those cases and applied to other similar situations. So just because something's not specifically described in the Old Testament law, and there's not particular guidance about that thing, there might be other laws that describe a similar circumstance, and we can apply those in principle to other things. And that's the way all ancient law worked. Statutory law is a gift of the Romans in many respects to the modern world. That's the way they tended to approach it. Most statutory law systems are based on Roman law, particularly in the West. But that's just not the way the Hebrews thought about law. Now, it's all of it together, the highest form of law that concerns us tonight is the idea of a covenant. We've talked about this before. A covenant is a type of contract, but it's more significant than contract like you might sign with like a repairman to fix something in your house or your work or something. It is legally binding in that same way, but covenants were often between kings and their vassals. And so they're more like treaties, which govern the way nations relate to each other. And they were often witnessed by the gods and ratified in the gods' presence. And so they had a solemnity to them, and the vows had a weightiness to them that may not be the case if your plumber doesn't get the job done when he says he's going to. And I mention that because all of the Torah is basically covenant. And we have surviving forms of covenants from the ancient world besides just in the Bible. And the structure of the Pentateuch itself, starting in Genesis and working its way through Deuteronomy, ending with those blessings and curses, which we'll get to later tonight, actually follows the structure of ancient covenantal forms. And one of the most significant components of ancient covenants, as a king is engaging in some kind of negotiation with an underling, he would begin his contractual form with a description of all the things that he had done for that person, and therefore why they owed him his allegiance. And that's basically what the book of Genesis is doing. It's a preamble. It's God setting up the giving of the law at Sinai by showing the Israelites the promises that he made to the patriarchs, to their forebears, that set them up to receive this law later. And God consistently appeals in the rest of the Pentateuch, especially Deuteronomy, to the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the basis for his relationship with Israel. And of course, it's rooted even deeper than that in God as creator and redeemer, creator of all things. So that's who God is, and that's why he has the authority to issue this covenant to us, because he's done all these things for us. He's created us, he sustained us, he's made promises to our forefathers, and now he's delivered us from bondage in Egypt. And Deuteronomy is also a covenant within there, and we'll get into that in more detail in a moment. We will be looking tonight at those elements of this part of the Bible that are law, in that sense we tend to think of. And the legal sections of the Pentateuch tend to all fall into three blocks. If you're ever curious to just read just the laws themselves and not just the rest of the Torah as a whole, the first chunk is in Exodus 20 through 23. And this is known as the Book of the Covenant. It's referred to as that explicitly at the end of 23. Exodus 20 begins with the Ten Commandments. Then there are a few other laws concerning slaves and some other basic how the Israelites are to govern themselves at a higher moral level. And then Exodus 24 conclude, or Exodus 23 transitions into Exodus 24, which is this grand covenant ratifying ceremony when Moses sacrifices some animals and he sprinkles some blood on the people of Israel, and they say, "We will obey every work of the every law, every word in the law." And then Moses sprinkles some blood on this altar that he builds. And it's only at that point, once the people have bound themselves to this particular portion of the covenant, that he goes up to the mountain and receives all the instructions about the tabernacle and whatever. Of course, while he's up there, the Israelites immediately violate this commandment and make for themselves the golden calf, the famous golden calf gate that we've talked about before. The next chunk of law is the book of Leviticus as a whole, but specifically within Leviticus, chapters 17 to 26 are known as the Holiness Code. And this is because, again and again, as God's giving instructions to the Israelites, he says this sort of refrain, "Be holy as I am holy," or "I, the Lord your God, am holy," or "I, the Lord your God, who redeemed you from Egypt, is holy." And it all has to do with, as we talked about two weeks ago now, how Israel is to organize itself vis-a-vis the tabernacle and the sacrificial system. Of course, the whole book of Leviticus includes laws for the priests and how the sacrifices are being conducted. But this section right here seems to include a lot of ethical commandments about sexual morality, how we treat slaves, those kinds of things that you might normally associate with just civil life. But all within the context of Israel's vocation to be a holy nation. And the last chunk of law is the book of Deuteronomy. Again, as a whole, but specifically within Deuteronomy, chapters 12 through 26 are known as the Deuteronomic Law. And some scholars have speculated that, those chapters basically amount to an extended commentary on the Ten Commandments. And some scholars have made attempts to try and map that, those sections to the commandments in the order in which the commandments are given. And chapters 4 through 11 are this long-winded preamble and exhortation for Israel to be faithful to the law of the covenant. Moses is basically unpacking for the people what the law is and encouraging them to be faithful to it. And because it's a summary of, in some sense, what had already gone before, it is called Deuteronomy, which just means second law. Second law. It's literally what it means in the Greek. Anybody want to venture a guess why Moses is going through this process of repeating all the law that the Israelites have already received and asking them to bind themselves in faithfulness to it? What has transpired in Israel's history up to this point?
A new generation.
A new generation, right? Because this first part of the law was given to the Israelites at Sinai, that first generation that came out of Egypt. They were then faithless, and God led them around the desert for 40 years. During that time, they all died off. And so this generation that Moses is now speaking to on the edge of the promised land is a new generation, and they have to have the law re-ratified or, you know, reaffirmed in their case. So the book of Deuteronomy ends with a ratification ceremony where they re-ratify the law and bind themselves to it in faithfulness. Deuteronomy is, in that sense, actually very helpful for us because it's Moses' own commentary on the law. It's his own final sermon to his people right before he dies, urging them, encouraging them, exhorting them to be faithful to the law of God. And so he's offering all kinds of interesting explanations, particularly in that first part I had you read, which I asked you to read, whether you read it or not, why he thinks this is so important for them to do. And it brings us to this big question, I think, which preoccupies us this evening. Why the law? What's its point? Why did God give it? What function is it playing in the story of salvation? 2 weeks ago, I guess, it would have been 2 weeks ago, we talked about the tabernacle, right? We saw that Israel's national life was built around this whole idea of being holy. They're called to be holy. And this is symbolized by the fact that the tabernacle itself is right in the center of the Israelite camp. And then Jerusalem, where the temple ends up being built, is right in the center of the promised land. So it's right in the middle of the people are all around it. And the people are called to be holy. Their highest vocation is to be in the presence of God who is holy and to be holy as God is holy. Which is why there's a huge section of ethical commands within this whole book about holiness. The law itself, I'm going to suggest to you, functions as a sort of scaffold around this call, which provides the context in the real world in which this can be lived out. Right? And so it's actually a legal basis for Israel's relationship to God and their call to this. It provides boundary markers and guidelines for how they to organize themselves both privately, individually, within their families, and as a nation as a whole, so that they can live up to this call to be holy by God. And so law, in that sense, is the covenantal framework. It provides the basis of Israel's call to be holy. And it makes that call, living out that call, possible. It defines the boundaries, and it establishes around the people of Israel a precinct of holiness. Of course, God's ultimate purpose is to get Israel into the land, which he promised their forefathers, to put them in there. And the land itself becomes this image of God's holy proximity to his holiness. So the land itself is sacred. And so Israel has to engage in a manner of life which honors that sacredness, honors that holiness. And if they don't live up to that, well, we'll get to that in a moment. And this is the basis for that distinction. I've talked about this a little bit before, between holiness and holy on the one hand, and righteous or righteousness on the other. Now, righteousness has to do with one's fidelity to the legal covenant. You know, are they in, and are they doing what's necessary to stay in to God's legal precepts? And they're in so that they can be holy as God is holy, so they can be in his presence without being burned by it. And so when we talk about holiness or sanctity or sanctification, we're talking about becoming like God on the one hand. When we talk about righteousness or justification, these words come from the same roots in Greek and Hebrew, we're talking about the basis of that relationship, our legal standing, you might say, with God that makes that relationship possible. And so in some sense, the law comes first and makes the holiness possible. But the law, in that sense, is pointing to or sort of geared towards a manner of life, which is to be described as godlike, holy as God is holy. So there's an analogy for this in the natural world, I think. If we just consider natural law, let's say the natural law, just do the same diagram over here. Natural law serves, according to the story of creation, certainly, it serves a purpose. It serves a purpose. It's not just there to be there. Natural law provides the boundary lines. It creates the context within which life can flourish. Right? So in that sense, natural law is in service to life. The laws of creation, the laws of nature, the laws of the physical universe, which make our experience of life even possible. Modern science has discovered just how finely tuned all the laws and constants of our universe are, that if any one of them were just off by a little tiny fraction, none of the life that we know would be possible. And so everything is ordered towards the end of life, so that life can flourish and abound. And that law then is the boundary lines that make that possible. We tend to think of law as maybe oppressive, good Americans that we are. But law is what provides the basis for our life. It's what enables us to live and to live correctly. And when we try to flout the natural law, it often is to our physical detriment. You know, we throw ourselves off a building because I don't believe in gravity. It doesn't have any say over me. That's not exactly how it works now, is it? And there's a parallel here, and in Psalm 19 sort of makes that analogy of creation to the written law, that the written law is in some sense the same thing, except for in some mysterious way we humans do have the freedom to not follow the moral law, the eternal law of God, and still live at least temporarily in a way that natural law is a bit more immediate in its claims in our lives. I'm going to stop there and just put it to you guys if you have any questions about anything I've just said. We're dealing with some kind of high-level stuff here, but I think it's important to wrap our minds around how we can read this in a way that's helpful. Any questions? Anything about what I said that's not clear or confusing? Yeah, Michael.
So if if it's the case that moral law is the one that carries through to the Christians, I mean, there is, just even by the uses that are, you know, used to describe them as we read them, like civil law and ceremonial law seem to provide some kind of benefit in more than just sort of an allegorical sense.
Right.
And so why would it be that that benefit doesn't or shouldn't carry over into a Christian life?
Right. It's a good question. And I'll be returning to it in a moment. So hold that thought. And if I don't answer your question later, ask it again. Because I think it's I think that gets to the heart of the issue, how we read it well as Christians. Anything else? Okay, so let's just catch up to the narrative, okay? Last time we were in the story was Israel had now arrived at Moreb, or Mount Sinai, and God is giving them this law from the fire and the cloud of the mountain. Of course, Israel is brought out of Egypt because God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their forefathers, 400 years previous, that he would give their descendants the land of Canaan. And so they're in Egypt, he's brought them out of Egypt, and now he's preparing them to enter into the land of Canaan. Whence this 40 years that transpires between Mount Sinai and when they actually get there? Well, that wasn't plan A. God had asked them, that first generation, go in. And they send a bunch of spies in to sort of see how it was going to go for them in the land. And those spies come back, and all but two of them report that they're not able to defeat the people that are there already. That they're too mighty, and there's no way that the pity little Israel can have it. The two people, it's Caleb and Joshua, insist that they can do it, because God said he would do it for them. So who cares how fortified their cities are? Let's go. God says for us. The people rebel and say they won't do it, and so they're struck by, you know, plagues and whatnot, and they say they're sorry, and they decide to go into the land, and it was, okay, fine, we'll go in. God's like, no, you've already blown it, because you already didn't believe that I would do it for you, so now that plan's now off the table, and they're like, no, we'll go anyway, we believe now, and they go in, and they get routed. They get just crushed by their initial foray into the promised land by the people who live there already, the Canaanites. And so God tells them, because you didn't believe me, this generation is just, you're not holy enough to enter into this holy precinct of mine, which is the Holy Land, so you're just going to be stuck out here in the wilderness until they all die off. And the only exceptions to that are Caleb and Joshua, because they were faithful to God's word and wanted the people to go and take it. So Caleb and Joshua are the only members of that generation that are actually allowed to go into the promised land. And while they're in the desert, they do all kinds of things that are just crazy. You know, they're constantly grumbling, constantly complaining. As they engage with some of the people that live on the peripheries of the Sinai desert, they engage sexually with them. They worship their gods. And it's just, it's not pretty. At one point, they even incite Moses to anger against them. And Moses himself defies the word of God. And then God says to Moses, yeah, now you can't go into the promised land either. And so that whole generation then dies off in the wilderness because they're not able to be faithful to God's word and to take the land as God promised. Now this new generation has risen up, and Moses, and this is all recounted in the book of Numbers, Moses now brings them to the plains of Moab, which are on the opposite side of the Jordan River from Canaan. So Canaan is sort of between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, and the Sea of Galilee, and the Dead Sea. Across from the Jordan River, what's now modern state of Jordan, are the plains of Moab. That's where they are. And they're just getting ready to cross the river. The Jordan River kind of represents a boundary line. And so this is Moses' final word to them before they cross over. And so he offers in this initial exhortation, this chapters 4 through 11, a number of important clues about what the law is for, why God has given it to them, why he wants them to be faithful to it. And I've broken it up into two major things. The law is meant to be a sign for Israel, and it's also meant to be a sign for the nations. There's a couple of interesting clues in there about God's plan beyond just Israel at this particular stage of salvation history. What is it a sign for Israel of? That God himself has set them apart according to his own purposes and his own designs, and has nothing to do with Israel deserving it. God again describes, you know, again and again, there's this refrain, chapter 4, 32 to 36, chapter 6, 10 through 19, many other places, that God is the one who brought them out of Egypt and God led them out of slavery, that God brought them through the wilderness and provided for them while they were there, that God, they've already had a couple of initial skirmishes with the Canaanite tribes living on the east bank of the Jordan. They've defeated them, the kings of Sihon and Og. And so God's, I defeated these mighty kings for you. And so just again and again, he's reminding them that you're not here because you did anything. I'm entirely the architect of your being here and of your being a nation that's unique and distinct and out of Egypt. And so the law in that sense is a sign to the Israelites that God is the one who made them. It's God's law which they possess. And therefore they have access to a wisdom which is not of their own making. It comes from heaven. And there's wonderful description in chapter 6, 10 through 19, where God is just sort of describing in detail how they're going into a land full of houses they did not build, and they're going to join vineyards they didn't plant, and they're going to have livestock they didn't raise. And the whole image here is that all the Canaanite stuff, which God's giving to them, right? He's going to displace the Canaanites to do it. We'll get to that next week. But that even their cities and all their crops, they didn't build any of that. God just gave it to them freely. And so Israel is just kind of a passive recipient of all of this. God is the architect of who they are and of their national purpose. It's also a sign to them that God has separated them from the nations. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 11 in Deuteronomy is this long description of how Israel is to treat the Canaanites once they get into the land. And it's pretty gruesome stuff. We'll get into this in more detail next week, because it's probably one of the hardest bits of the Bible for us modern Christians to fully understand. But what's going on there is that God wants them to be clear that I don't want you intermingling with the Canaanites. If you do, if you intermarry with them, you're going to inevitably start worshiping their gods. And when that happens, things are going to go bad for you in the land that I've given you. That's a phrase that keeps going again and again, so that it may go well for you in the land, so that it won't go badly for you in the land. And so one of the reasons why God wants to displace the Canaanites is because he wants Israel itself to remain undefiled and pure. And he knows if they don't do that, the Canaanites will corrupt them and make them to look just like themselves, which is, in some sense, what the book of Judges describes. One commentator describes the book of Judges as the story of Israel's Canaanization, because they don't drive out the nations and they end up becoming just like the Canaanites. And it goes badly for them. And so part of the way that God reinforces for them, and you see all these weird laws about fabrics being mixed together and not plowing fields and multiple different kinds of things, are symbolically trying to reinforce this reality that Israel is separate from the nations. And that's especially exemplified in the way they are to treat the nations, especially the nations that are in the promised land that God is giving them. It's also a sign to Israel that they are not more righteous than the Canaanites. And this is perhaps one of the most interesting elements of the Deuteronomic law. In chapter 9, verses 4 through 8. So the first part starts with encouraging them not to be afraid of the people who are in the land, that they're too mighty for them. Know that therefore the one who goes before you is a consuming fire. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. And then in verse 4, God says this. He's saying this to the chosen people. Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of those nations the Lord is driving them out before you. Is it struggling? Okay. And so God's not bringing the Israelites in because they're better than the Canaanites necessarily. I mean, the Canaanites are pretty bad, and that's ultimately why they're being driven out. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations the Lord your God is driving them out before you, and that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. And then it goes on to offer extended commentary about what major event in Israel's history? Golden Calf Gate. He just tells the story again. Like, just let's just rework it, people. Let's remember what happened. And he goes on to describe the stubbornness of their fathers in the wilderness. And so he's trying to reinforce for Israel, like, you're not special in yourselves. The only reason you're special is because God made a promise to your forefathers and he's fulfilling it. The only reason you're special is because God himself has chosen to take you out of the nation where he found you and to make you into a holy nation by his own initiative. Nothing about you was ready for that. And indeed, that's proven by the fact that you've resisted it from day one and that you're a stubborn people. And Moses will return to this point later as he progresses. So that's how it's assigned to Israel. That's how the law functions as a sign to Israel. And all the laws and precepts are designed to sort of teach them these things. But it's also not just for Israel. It's also just not for Israel. It's also a sign to the nations. It's a sign to the nations. Chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. God says to the Israelites, or Moses says to them, keep them and do them, the commandments, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that he has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I have set before you today? Israel is supposed to knock the socks off the nations because of how wise they are governed as a people. How wise they're governed. And Moses anticipates this. You remember that story when God is just, it's after Golden Calf Gate, and God's just like, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses says, don't do it, don't do it. You remember one of the arguments that Moses makes to God, why he shouldn't do it? It's on this same theme of the nations. What argument does Moses make? The Egyptians will hear about it. And what will the Egyptians think? What do you mean? What kind of God is this that he brings his people out just to destroy them? What kind of God is that? Right? And so Moses is jealous for God's own character. Don't do it, because what are the Egyptians going to say? Right? Later in the book of Ezekiel, when the prophet's prophesying about all of Israel's failures and how the nation was driven into exile and defeated by these pagan armies, God says to them, I'm going to drive you out, and you know what? I'm going to bring you guys back into the land. Why? Because you've profaned my name among the nations. By their gods defeating your God, which is me, which they think is the case, but not really, they think their gods are better than me, and I'm not going to let them think that for very long. Right? So God is concerned. He's zealous for his own character. And so Israel's life as a nation is meant to show forth God's goodness, God's wisdom, God's holiness. And it's particularly when we compare the law to the surrounding laws of the culture that we begin to see some of those aspects of it that are really quite unique in the ancient world, which we might nowadays, as modern Americans, take for granted. One interesting feature of the law of Moses, which is very unique, there's no other law in the ancient world that does this. All people are treated equally before the law. There's no divisions in the law based on class or wealth. If you read the law of Hammurabi, which is a Babylonian law which precedes the law of Moses by several centuries, the gradations of punishments are situated there based on how much money you have, how wealthy you are, what your standing is. And as you might expect, the harsher punishments tend to fall on poor people than on the rich people. And if a poor person murders another poor person, the law is less severe on them than if a poor person murders a rich person, in which case the full force of the law comes down on them. So there's all these divisions based on how much money you have, with, of course, the wealthy and the powerful receiving all kinds of assurances and loopholes to get out of punishments. And that's actually pretty typical. The Egyptian laws have similar provisions. There's nothing like that anywhere in the law of Moses. Even the poor and the destitute and even the foreigners in the land have protection before the law in a way that is true for the king and for the elders. There's no sense of any division based on wealth. There's also a very, very strong concern for the poor and the marginalized. We'll look at this in a moment in more detail. But God almost seems to favor the poor people and is constantly asking Israel to remember them. You know, immediately after the Ten Commandments is this long section about how to treat slaves. Why? Remember that you were once slaves in Egypt and I brought you out of there. God doesn't want them to forget that they also came out of that same station and to treat those people with disrespect. He wants them to be respected and honored as the image bearers that they are. And so God has all kinds of laws and provisions for how the Israelites are to provide for the poor in their midst. The penalties are also proportionate and reasonable. And that may sound odd to us today, but that famous law, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, we tend to hear that now and think how barbaric. You know, if you pluck out my eye, I get to pluck out yours. Or if you pluck out my tongue, I get to pluck out yours. That seems grotesque. But actually, that's designed to limit responses to harms committed. And again, we see this in the surrounding laws that, remember that story of Lamech in Genesis 4, that some guy shoved him or looked at him badly, and Lamech killed him. Like, that's his response. Like, how dare you disrespect Lamech? And he struck him down. And he added all these imprecatory curses onto that guy's family, and these disproportionate responses that aren't at all level to the crime committed. God is trying to limit that excess by saying, like, look, the punishment should fit the crime, and that you shouldn't go beyond if you've been affected, if you're rich or whatever. And so that's actually, in the ancient context, designed to be a restraint on just excess bloodshed for wrongs committed. And you see within that proportionality, if you look at the Ten Commandments as a hierarchy of values within Israel, and it corresponds exactly to the penalties that are inscribed for infractions of those things, God seems to favor life significantly more than he favors property. Remember, we had this question a couple weeks back. How come, because I made that argument to you guys, that there was no atonement with the sacrificial system for sins committed. And then I think it was Abigail mentioned, well, there are some provisions for, like, if you lie in a court of law or if you steal some guy's stuff, there is sacrifice along with compensation for the wrong committed. And what I said to her at the time, and I've gone back through and tried to, I think that's correct, is that those things are crimes in the law of Moses for which the death penalty is not ascribed. And so stealing, bearing false witness, certainly coveting, which the law would have a hard time enforcing either way, there's no death penalty for those things. There's only death penalty for lying or bearing false witness if your false testimony results in the execution of somebody who's actually innocent, in which case you're viewed as having murdered them by your false testimony. And so we see that when God prescribes other means of recompense or punishment for crimes against property, which there are protections for, are significantly less severe than crimes against life, crimes against the sanctity of marriage, crimes against the duly established authorities, especially as seen in honor thy father and mother, which in the commentary on that commandment in Deuteronomy talks a lot about elders too, not just your parents, but sort of judges that God places in the land as well, and the king, and how you're supposed to treat them. And so God cares more about, in that sense, submission to authority and respect for life than he cares about property. Now, he cares about property too. I'm not saying he doesn't care about it. But that the way we see God assigning penalties gives us some sense about where his priorities are, where his values are, as the ultimate lawgiver. So that's how the Israelite nation is meant to by the way they live their lives, supposed to show forth the wisdom of God to the nations. But they're also supposed to, the law is also assigned to the nations, not just for God's wisdom, but also, interestingly enough, for God's holiness, which you tend to think is something that only Israel is about, in the know on. At the end of chapter 29, verses 24 through 28, God is describing what's going to happen to the Israelites if they're kicked out of the land because they're disobedient. You know, they're going to be exiled. And then Moses, now speaking in the guise of the nations, verse 24, all the nations will say, so what are the nations now saying in response to Israel's being kicked out of their land? Why has the Lord done thus to this land? What caused the heat of this great anger? Then the people will say, the nations will say, so this is now the nations commenting themselves on what they've witnessed God do to his people. It is because they, that is the Israelites, abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their father, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt, and went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they had not known and whom he had not allotted to them. Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land, bringing upon it the curses written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and fury and great wrath, and cast them into another land as they are this day. This is what the observing nations are saying about Israel's fate, right? So they have some sense, because of the way God treats his own people, about the way he is for everyone, right? They're learning by watching Israel's own life with God who God is and what his ways are, and that he does not abide unfaithfulness to his covenant, that he does not abide worshiping other gods. He does not abide a thankless attitude towards his savings acts. So the law is a witness even to the nations, a sign to the nations for who God is and who he calls Israel to be. So having laid all that down, any questions about any of that before we proceed? Yeah. Right. I think that's a good observation. Yeah.
I don't know if there's any example in the ancient world of another civilization that's basing its laws.
Yeah. Most laws tend to be, they tend to be promulgated on the king's authority because he said so, and
right.
Oftentimes they're testimonies to his wisdom or his righteousness. But
or the authority of God.
Right. So the fact that the nations can see just sort of objectively, like, wow, you guys got it going on, is sort of a testimony to reason as an enduring principle of creation. Yeah. I want to make an argument here, which might be controversial. I'm of the opinion that when we talk about the law being abrogated or fulfilled in Christ, I think that's true for all of it. I don't think there's a moral law as such which continues to be binding as a law on Christians. I think the law has a very specific role within the story of salvation, and it's all enshrined within this covenant that God makes for Israel. And when they break it, the covenant is broken, right? And God talks about, in Deuteronomy, having to do something new. And so it's the whole foundation of this idea in Jeremiah that God's going to give them a new covenant, which they can't break. The idea is the old one's now broken, right? So it's nullified. It can't be stitched back together. And so when Christ comes and fulfills the law, and we'll get into how he does that much later, but just as a principle, I want to say that the law as this external thing to us that God gives the human race at this point in history, and keep in mind again, we take this thing for granted, the human race would have no knowledge of this had God not given it to Israel. We wouldn't have known about his ways. You know, the fact that he's spoken to this particular group of people is why we know that he's spoken at all. As Paul says in Romans, how would I have known that I shouldn't covet if the law had not said, thou shalt not covet? Right, so the law in that sense is new to the human race. We're now learning about this for the first time. This is what God's standards are. But having fulfilled its purpose, it's no longer now binding in that way. You know, the law of Moses is now fulfilled. And so all the things which pertain to the law of Moses, including all the various laws about holy days and even the ethical laws, as such, are no longer binding on Christians. But I do think that once we sort of situate the law in its context and begin to discern some of the principles behind why, as far as we can reconstruct them, we can actually do quite a bit, why the law may be structured the way it is and how God seems to be prioritizing things and how the laws around the land work, we can, in fact, distill moral principles that tell us true things about God's eternal standards. And that those things do continue to be descriptive for Christians. But I want to emphasize, not as a law, but as just the truth of who we are and who God's calling us to be as members of Christ. We live kind of in a strange realm of already and not yet as Christians. We'll get into this later. So in that sense, the law still kind of comes at us as a law in some way. We still feel it in that kind of burdensome way. But the whole point of the difference is that the law is now no longer external to us, but internal to us by the power of the Holy Spirit. And so we can learn, but that being said, we can learn about God's sort of moral character and apply principles from the law. And I just want to do a quick case study on the way the laws concerning Sabbath and Jubilee years. Every 7 years, the people of Israel were to not till the land. Just let it go fallow. And God told them that if they did this, that he would provide for them plenteously that sixth year. So they would have plenty of food for that seventh year. And then also for the eighth year when they're sowing again after that year of fallowness. Every 7 years, they're also supposed to manumit the slaves. So anybody that sells themselves into bond service, this one way that you get out of debt back then is that you would sell yourself to somebody else for a period of time to work off your debt. But all debts of that kind in Israel had a maximum term of 7 years. No questions asked. Every Sabbath year, every person who had sold themselves, even if they'd sold themselves the year before, was to be manumitted without any payment to the person who they sold themselves to. Their debt's just forgiven. And in fact, it goes even further than that. When Moses comments on this law, which is found in Leviticus 25, he comments on it in Deuteronomy 15, and he says, And when you let them go free from you, you shall not let them go empty-handed. You shall furnish them liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this day. So don't just manumit them. Give them stuff. Help them reestablish themselves in the land, right? That's every 7 years. That's the Sabbath year. Every seventh year is the year of Jubilee. And what would happen in the year of Jubilee was a Sabbath year on steroids. In addition to people just being manumitted from slavery and being given sort of a basic stock by which they can rebuild their economic base, all of the ancestral land within Israel is to be returned to its families. So if you read in Numbers, God describes in minute detail how the land is to be divided up. And a lot of Bibles actually include maps in the back, which show you, like this one here, how the tribes are to have the land. This is all very particularly described in the book of Numbers. And so these tribal allotments are actually given to Israel by God. You know, that Manasseh is here, and Dan is here, and Judah is here, and you guys have this land, and he defines boundary markers for them. And that goes all the way down to tribal lines. The tribes have this chunk of land, and within those tribes, these families have these lands. Over the course of 50 years, land's going to be bought and sold. Someone might go and sell themselves into servitude and give away their land to pay off their debts. And so their family will be taken away from their land. Of course, God promised Israel the land. So our access to God's blessings is our access to the land. And so if I no longer have access to it and my children no longer have access to it, then I'm in some sense cut off from God's promise. So God says every 50 years, give it back. You know, whoever has it now, give it back to the family member who first sold it, or if they've died, to their descendants. And so every 50 years, there'd be this massive reshuffling, and Israel would go back to those original tribal allotments. And it's one of the reasons why, I remember the story from, I think, 1 Kings, when the king of Israel wants to take Naaman's vineyard, and Naaman says, I can't sell it to you. He says, it's because it's my family inheritance. I'm bound by God to this piece of land. I can't give it. I mean, if I could, I would. I can't. And then Jezebel tells him to kill him and take it anyway. So it's not just an injustice because he steals property. He's also flouting God's own good gift to that family by making it impossible for his family to reclaim, because I think he kills all his sons too, and to reclaim that property, which God prescribes needs to happen every 50 years. Now, we can't reenact this, right? We can't do this now. We can't, you know, give Hillsdale County back to the Potawatomi Indians every 50 years. We don't live in that world. Right, but can we distill certain principles from this law which can enable us to understand what God cares about? You know, first of all, he wants us to trust him so plentifully that sixth year, and you will reap plentifully, I will provide for you. So in that seventh year, you'll have food. In fact, Moses even sets it up that way. How am I going to eat if I don't harvest? Trust me, if you sow the land fruitfully, that sixth year, I will bless you with a double fold crop. And then you'll have what you need for the following 2 years. And of course, that's what God does with the manna, if you remember, on the Sabbath days. He gives them double on Friday so they have enough on Saturday when there's no manna coming. So it's a call to trust. Trust me with your possessions. You can give away your stuff on the basis of trusting in me, because I will make sure you're provided for. But the other interesting principle in all this is that God has a concern for the poor. And many scholars have noted that if this system had actually been faithfully followed, which of course it wasn't, and that 70 years that God promises that they'll go into exile is actually the 70 years of, I think, Sabbath years they skipped as a country. God's like, the land's going to get its rest one way or the other. It seems to prevent against people falling into poverty and then being stuck there permanently. It's that grinding poverty which becomes very difficult to extricate ourselves from. Because once you have no resources, then how are you supposed to build back up your resources? And God seems to want there to be intentional efforts of his people to live in a way that costs us things, right? You're supposed to let the slave go free without any payment to myself. I'm supposed to return parcels of land to the family that used to own it without payment. There's no provision for payment. I have to just give it up. It's now in my possession. It's no longer in my possession. God calls us to radical generosity so that people don't just get stuck in these cycles of poverty they can't get themselves out of. That's a wonderful way to understand God's concern for the plight of people economically in a fallen world where resources are not distributed evenly. That within the law of Israel, we see this wisdom Obviously, we can't apply it directly, you know, word for word to our modern circumstance, but it does teach us as Christians about the way we should prioritize our wealth and what we should be concerned about as the church, which is why the church has always been one of the great agents of ministry to the poor. I want to transition just in conclusion here, just by appealing to this book right here. If you're curious about how the Old Testament law can be read in a way that helps understand how it applies to us today, this book was like probably my top three books I was assigned in seminary. It's called Old Testament Ethics and the People of God. And it's a wonderfully accessible study of how does the law work, and what does it have to teach Christians about what we're supposed to do to honor God. Very, very interesting insight. And it was from him that I got this bit about the Sabbath year. So I think you should have a copy of this on your bookshelf. You can read it in little sections. And if you're curious about how the law works, I think it's very, very helpful. You can look at that after we're done. Okay, I want to conclude now with, I talked about how the law is a blessing and a curse. It's the title of this lesson, and I'll be quick with this. It's a blessing, of course, I hope we can see by now, because it reveals God's wisdom. It reveals his order, his justice. It reveals his desire to redeem and to love and to save. And so the law is a blessing to the people of Israel and to the nations who are watching it unfold. And Israel is told that if she continues to obey the law, it will continue to be a blessing for her. That God will bless the land and it will bear fruit for her, and that the nations will be in awe of her. But the book of Deuteronomy concludes with curses, blessings and curses. This was a standard way covenants would end, if you disobey the covenant. Notice that Israel has obligations. This is not like God's covenant with Abraham, where only God himself made himself party to the covenant. Remember that scene where the animals were divided and only God went through it? Abraham's asleep. In that sense, the covenant's only binding for God. In this case, Israel now has an obligation. The covenant obligations now do, in fact, go both ways. And if Israel's faithless, God will drive them out of the land. And there's that long series of curses. As you read them, just notice that the ultimate point of all of them is you will be kicked out of the land. That's how it culminates. If you're not faithful, you won't get to stay. The land will kick you out. God uses that language. The land will vomit you out. It's not even God doing it. It's the Holy Land itself, just expelling them, like you might cough out, an intrusive invader. That's how the land's being described here. Like it's going to kick Israel out. And so God lays it out for them quite clearly. I'm giving you this day, life or death. Choose this day. You know, I'm laying it out for you, nice and clear. God's not a liar. He's a truth teller. This is just how it works. So when the prophets prophesy exile as a punishment for Israel's sin later, they're not just making that up. They're appealing to Deuteronomy, to the curses of Deuteronomy. But even more than that, it's actually predicted that Israel is going to fail. It's not just, here are the curses, here are the blessings, here are the curses, and now, you know, the sky's the limit, Israel, pick. Moses is done now with his sermon. He's handed off authority to Joshua. It's the very end of the book. He's talking now to the Levites privately. He says, put all this in the Ark of the Covenant. But then he says to the Levites this thing. This is chapter 31, verses 26, starting with 26. He says, this is Moses talking, for I know how rebellious and stubborn you are. Behold, even today, while I am yet alive with you, you have been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? Assemble to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears, and I call heaven and earth to witness against them. It's legal language, right? The witnesses of the covenant are the created elements themselves. For I know that after my death you will surely act corruptly and turn aside from the way that I have commanded you. In the days to come, evil will befall you, because you will do what is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger through the works of your hands. Israel has this law, but the law itself does not empower them to be faithful to it. All it does is show them what God's standards are and quite plainly explain what the consequences will be for them if they don't follow it. So even when they know the truth, even when they have all the information they need to be faithful, they still fail. And I think that we have to understand this as part of this unfolding story of salvation. What is Israel's role? It's to reveal to the human race both God's righteous standards and our failure to carry them out. And Israel itself demonstrates that by its own failure. After all the blessings she receives as a nation, all the advantage she could possibly have, this great law and this great provision, she still can't do it. And God has to find another way to bring it about, the blessings he promised to all the nations through Abraham's descendants. Because, of course, that part of the covenant And that was in Galatians reading. That precedes the law. That's God's promise to Abraham, which has no stipulations attached to it. So the law, in that sense, is in service to that prior promise that God is going to bless all the nations through Israel. And if Israel fails and is driven out of the nations, how are they going to do that? How is God going to fulfill his promise to Abraham that he would do it unconditionally? And that's where, in chapter 30, after God sort of outlines all these curses, God tells the Israelites that when you are scattered abroad among the nations where I will send you, I will have compassion and bring you out and bring you back into this land. God promises to restore them, right? And that becomes the basis of all the prophetic warnings about exile and promises that God will bring the Israelites back. Not because they've deserved it. No, Jeremiah, new covenant. I'll put my law in their hearts, Ezekiel. Now, God's got a plan B in mind, because Moses predicts that plan A is not going to work and that Israel is going to show forth just how stubborn our hearts are. So that's the law. That's what I think is going on. Any questions about any of that? That's the last thing I have to say for tonight. Yeah, Tim.
Has Israel been brought back to the land?
We'll get to that later. We're not there yet, Tim. They're on the verge of the land, brother, so that's where they're going next. We'll get to that later. That's a very difficult issue in biblical theology, but we'll get to it. Any other questions? Yeah, Emily.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your two bits on the Jerusalem Council reported in Acts 15 when the apostles are dealing with the question of how much of the law do we ask Christian converts to obey?
Mm-hmm.
And they choose the three things of avoiding things polluted by idols, sexual immorality, and strangled meats.
Right. I think they're doing what I'm describing here, is that rather than just applying the law one-to-one, they're distilling principles of moral behavior that I think, in particular with the case of the Gentiles to whom they're writing, they know is going to be a major problem for them. And what do we know about ancient Roman society? It was just completely awash in idols and idolatry, and it was very sexually loose. And so when God is writing to the Corinthians, he again and again, he's coming back to those issues, you know, that they're struggling in these areas. So I think they're just saying, like, for you, this is what I think what you're going to struggle with. Just live in accordance with God's standards for sex and don't worship other gods, you know. And the fact that they don't give them the whole Levitical code about all the sexual relations, I think is interesting. You know, just be sexually pure. Well, what does that mean? Jesus, it wasn't that way in the beginning. In the beginning, God created man and woman, you know. So I think that's what's going on. And we can get into that in more detail when we get to the New Testament, but yeah. I'm happy to keep answering questions. I want to let you guys go because I've gone over. Next week will be our last time we meet together for 2 weeks. And next week we're going to be talking about the conquests, which, like I said, I think is the hardest part of the Old Testament for us to swallow as Christians. So I want you to read Deuteronomy chapter 20, where Moses provides some basis for how they're to wage that war, kind of war. And then Joshua 6, which is the famous story of Israel conquering Jericho. Jericho is right across the Jordan River from where Moses just preached the sermon. So it's their very first, you know, engagement in the Promised Land. So we're going to talk a little bit about holy war and how that fits into this whole schema we've talked about and how we as Christians might be able to wrap our minds around it in a way that's helpful. So that's for next Wednesday night.